Veterans salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Welcome, it's Tuesday and you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. How are you, Tim?
Doing very well.
Good. Hey, listen, we've got a great week lined up. Let's go over this, shall we?
Yep.
I want to mention this weekend, I'll be hosting Coast to Coast AM Friday and Saturday, Tim.
Wow.
Friday and Saturday.
Wow.
We'll be talking about the Jordan Codices on Friday night. Saturday night, our good friend Bill Burns is going to join us talking about the telephone to the dead, the race to communicate to the other side, Tesla versus Edison in the all-out one-on-one man of war. That's going to be pretty cool. I'm excited about both shows, so I'll be hosting Coast to Coast AM. If you want to find a way to listen to it, download the app knsiradio.com, knsiradio.com. Go to their website, download the free app, and you can listen to Coast every time I'm hosting right from their app. They are our home for Beyond the Darkness and our home for Coast to Coast AM whenever I record with the show. So that's what's going on at the end of the week. Today is Tuesday, Tim, so it's also True Crime Tuesday.
Yes, it is.
Oh, boy. Ooh,
it's a good
one.
The
curse, the last word.
Yeah.
That's today's topic on True Crime Tuesday. A clash between good and evil strikes up on the high plains of Texas when Johnny Frank Garrett, a 17-year-old retarded boy, is arrested, convicted, and ultimately executed for the Halloween night rape, mutilation, and murder of Sister Teda Benz. Garrett claimed his innocence, Tim, from the time of his arrest until his dying breath. 16 years after his execution, new evidence rose up from the cold case grave of the Amarillo Police Department proving they executed the wrong man.
Ooh.
That's not the end of the story.
Really?
In Garrett's final written statement, he professed his innocence one last time, but did it in a voice driven by hate and vengeance. In his chilling conclusion, Garrett promised those responsible for his murder that someday he would have the last word and they would pay for what they had done. In that letter, Garrett casts a curse on those responsible for his wrongful conviction. Many people connected in Garrett's case, Tim, confronted horrible tragedies beginning soon after the execution.
Really?
Yeah. That's the case we've got on True Crime Tuesday. Mm. Plus, dumb crimes, stupid criminals. And I'll address this real quickly. We had some complaints last week, Tim.
Okay.
I know it's hard to believe listeners complaining.
No.
Because we didn't get to dumb crimes, stupid criminals. We are only allotted a two-hour slot for that show. And as promised, we can deliver you a 90-minute to two-hour show. We filled all 2 hours talking about the true crime. So we will bring you more dumb crime, stupid criminals when we can fit them into the episodes. They're more of kind of a filler and a fun getaway. But we had a two-hour show with a two-hour guest that had fascinating stuff to share. That's why we weren't able to get to the dumb crime, stupid criminals aspect. Okay? Betsy Lewis joins us tomorrow. Ancient serpent gods, the alien connection to reptilian dinosaurs, Tim.
Hmm.
Then on Thursday, kind of a controversial show, Lucifer, Origins and Revelations. That's Priscilla Vogelbacher that'll be joining us. And Friday, Scott Marlowe will be talking about cryptids in Florida. If we don't have enough reasons after reading Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals to avoid Florida, Tim, if we don't have enough reasons after watching viral videos of alligators jumping into people's pools while they're swimming We don't have enough reason to not want to go to Florida by seeing people drag rattlesnakes out from underneath their dashboards in their car, Tim.
Yeah.
Scott Marlowe's going to give us a whole bunch more reasons to avoid Florida.
So theme parks are the only redeeming social value to Florida.
I'm not even sure. They have them in California, Tim.
No, that's true.
They have them in California. Yeah. Same ones I want to go see in Florida.
Yeah.
And I don't have to put up with Florida man, Florida woman, Florida in general is trying to kill you. I believe Florida is the Australia of the United States. Everything in Florida wants to kill you, Tim.
But see, we love Australia.
We do, but everything in Australia wants to kill you.
That's true.
That is the truth. Today, though, Tim, we're gonna take a look at vampires.
Oh.
Yeah. Ronald Murphy Jr. is joining us, Tim, discussing his book on vampires. He is a cryptozoologist and folklorist, and he journeys throughout history in his quest to uncover the impetus for the archetype of the vampire, beginning at the lair of cannibals at the dawn of human history, exploring the images and evolving ideas of the vampire, and tracing those concepts up to the information age. He's here with us this evening. He's graduated from the University of Pittsburgh, Tim, with a degree in literature and religious studies, and attended graduate school at Pitt and at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, where he studied history. He's also a professional actor, having appeared in movies, television, and on stage. He is also a researcher and historical reenactor for the Underground Railroad in Blairsville, Pennsylvania, and he is considered an international expert on fairy lore and has researched the unexplained from Maine to Florida, as well as in the United Kingdom. He's here with us this evening. We can't be more happy. Thank you so much for joining us, Ron.
Gentlemen, I'm very, very flattered that you asked me on the show, and listening to the lead-in and spending some time in Florida myself, I do agree that everything in Florida will kill you in one way or the other.
Yes, it's trying to. There's no Flacca is big in Florida now, too. The zombie. Ah, Tim, did you see that? The zombie drug is back in full force.
Flacca. Well, I don't know about full force.
I do. It's taking over different states. People are eating people, Tim. Flacca.
You might be blowing that a little out of proportion.
No, not at all.
Just a little
whatever.
Bit.
All right, Ron, let's talk. So you are an expert in fairy legend and lore. I've heard some weird connections, if you don't mind me asking real quick. I've heard some weird connections to people that believe that vampires fall into that spectrum of being perhaps part of the fairy realm. Do you see any connection to that?
Absolutely, and so did Bram Stoker. The word Dracula actually has a counterpoint in Irish legend, and there's something over there with the same sound of Dracula, and that is a bloodthirsty fairy that lives in the wastelands in Ireland. So it's very interesting to see that Stoker was not only pulling on Vlad the Impaler as as subject matter for his Dracula, but also pulling from his traditions within Ireland of bloodthirsty fairies. So fairies are these rather nebulous creatures that exist as elementals, straddling the physical world and the incorporeal world. So I think that there is something to be said about fairies in the vampire connection, because vampires are said to be able to transform into fog, to transform at will into a bat, the same thing as fairies. It's just very interesting to see that there tends to be this overlapping between fairies and what we would call vampiric entities.
See, now that's a fascinating aspect to me, that there might be some connection to this fairy legend and lore. Was that something that had kind of been in the back of your mind when you started researching on vampires?
It did. It was. As you said, I studied history in graduate school, and I really came upon the idea of the fairy realm very serendipitously. I was researching actually Renaissance belief in folktales and folk legends, and it came out that there was a lot of fairy connections to it. And whenever I was, studying this at, 26 years old, I always kind of thought of fairies as, what Disney had sold us, as kind of Tinkerbell with diaphanous wings, flitting around and things. But whenever you're looking at the folklore from the Middle Ages up into the Renaissance and even up into the Victorian era, fairies were something that were very feared And as I was starting to research into to vampires, I thought, you know, all these connections coming back to me about people that were mysteriously ending up dead in the Middle Ages, and they were blamed upon, the deaths was blamed upon, you know, fairy activity. It kind of started to make sense to me. So I do have, you know, statements in the book, historical statements, that sometimes tends to point towards fairies as the suspect behind certain vampiric activities.
Yeah, where do you, you know, and I want to get into the vampiral aspect of this, but the idea that fairy legend and lore is so prevalent, where does this stem from? I mean, do we see any point in history where this springs up? Was it meant to be children's tales, fables to keep kids in line? Do they have a real belief in these beings existing?
Well, that's a very, very good point. And I think whenever anybody talks about the paranormal or they talk about anything that goes bump in the night, they don't take into consideration that there had to be some sort of beginning to these kind of tales. And as a researcher into the world of the unexplained, that is really my bread and butter. That's kind of my go-to area, that my meat and potatoes. I truly love the idea of Jungian psychology and philosophy being applied to the world of the paranormal. I think that we're talking about archetypes here. We're talking about creations of the collective unconscious, so that we are personifying things that have been with us since we first left the savannas of Africa. I truly do believe that. Vampires in this case have been personified, you know, as, you know, disease carriers and as things that come in through the darkness of night and everything, because that's the way our mind can understand it. When we look at the idea of fairies, we're talking about a world stretching back to animism, you know, shamanism, the belief that all of nature is imbued with an intelligent spirit. And that goes back to, you know, the very, very beginnings of who we are as human beings. And I start out my book on vampires at the very beginning in England. We see the idea of these, you know, what creatures, what have you, coming out of the darkness and feeding upon the living. That was a belief that was, you know, entrenched in who we are as human beings. And all we have to do is be alone in the middle of the night sometime, and those kind of fears start rushing back into us. You know, vampires need us as much as we need them. You know, they are part of us. They are embroidered into our human DNA. And I think that they've been with us since the very beginning. Now, I'm not sure in what form they've taken. You know, they've actually changed and transformed with every generation. You know, they mean something to different generations every time they make an appearance. But surely vampires and the idea of fairies have been with us since we've been called human beings up into the present age.
And how far back, I mean, when you're researching this, where do you start to see the genesis of these beings being shared either through oral, through literature, or through, you know, pictograms, cryptograms, any kind of messages that may have been left behind on wall paintings or tapestries?
Yes, you know, that's a great point. You know, whenever we start looking into representations on rock art, you know, you could go back to the Aborigines of Australia and the idea of their dream time and the impressions they put on stone, which can go back as far as 30,000 years ago. I mean, this, we're talking about deep into human history. We've been anatomically human for about 200,000 years. So we're talking about when we left Africa, we're talking about 200,000 years, you know, ago. But, you know, it would take a while for us to establish cultures. It would take a while for us to move around this globe of ours. So it's pretty early. When we're talking about artwork that is 30,000 years ago in a place like Australia, we're talking about people had to leave Africa and venture out, you know, and conquer the seas and everything. But we're seeing artwork with, you know, these entities being portrayed that we really don't know what they are. I mean, some people have called them, you know, ancient astronauts because they look so foreign to us. But from the research that I've done, it seems to be part of their physical world. They're just struggling to identify what they're dealing with. It's a very fascinating part of anthropology. I mean, and you can study this academically, you know, what these kind of images mean. But whenever we look at the world of the vampire, there is an overlap there with the fairy realm as well, because the places where people were doing these artwork in these caves, you know, away from everybody, you know, to do some sort of sympathetic magic to somehow maybe, you know, help the hunt or whatever. We're talking about an area now in England that goes back to about 12,000 years ago where human remains were found within a cave system at the Cheddar Gorges, as a matter of fact, where the name Cheddar Cheese gets its origin from. But there was a site there at the Cheddar Gorge that, like I said, goes back to about 12,000 years, where there was direct evidence of harvesting human bones right alongside animal bones, as if the two there was no they were inconsequential what they were harvesting and what they were butchering there, and the human bones and the animal bones were side by side. There was no special attention paid to it, but the one fascinating part that makes this very relevant to our study of the vampire is that there were human skulls within that cave that were fashioned into drinking goblets, and within those human skulls was the remnants of human blood. So they were actually drinking, you know, blood, you know, from these human skulls. Now, what is interesting about this particular site from an anthropological point of view is that there's different types of cannibalism out there. One is endocannibalism, where, you know, certain cultures eat members of their own cultures for certain religious reasons, you know, to keep the spirit within the culture. And there's ectocannibalism, where you hunt outside of your group for those same type of quasi-religious purposes. But the thing about the Cheddar Cave incident, the Cheddar Gorge incident, is that it appears to be that the human beings were preyed upon simply for gastronomical reasons. They were fed upon simply for food without any ritual needed it whatsoever. And the other thing about this, which stretches back to our idea of vampires, is that these were young people. Two of them were children. One of them was an adolescent. So when we think about Dracula now in our contemporary times, when we look at Bram Stoker's Dracula, you know, there are children that are preyed upon within that book as well. And as we go through history looking at the vampire, children are usually the very first victims of the vampiric terror that goes out. And that's simply because, you know, they're preying upon the weak. And disease does this, and plague does this. But it's very interesting since, you know, we're talking about something, you know, 12,000 years ago that we start seeing the evidence of this within our human family.
I'm, you know, people are fascinated. I wanted to be a vampire when I was a kid so bad. I used to take my mom's emery board and file my canine teeth in hopes that I would eventually become a vampire if I made myself feel like a vampire. And why do you think people are so fascinated by that culture, by the whole idea of, you know, drinking blood, living forever, physical change?
Yep, physical change and everything like that. Well, whenever I was writing this book, many people would ask me, do you believe in vampires? And absolutely, you know, unequivocally, I do believe in vampires because there are human beings out there that identify as vampires. I mean, if you go onto the internet looking at vampires in the information age, you know, there's websites dedicated to the vampire lifestyle. Places like New Orleans, New York City have fetish clubs designed nothing but to cater to people that identify themselves with vampires. And in writing the book, as I delve deeper and deeper into this kind of subculture, you know, there are people out there that are willing to be hosts to allow their blood to be drank, you know, to be taken. And there are people out there that identify themselves as the dominant within it, and they're the vampire that does the blood drinking. So there's no lack of people out there that want to be prey and want to be predators. So they're definitely out there. But it does have to do with change. It has to do with people breaking free from society and kind of moving into the liminal areas. You know, people don't want to be identified as just, you know, a human being. That's boring and that's, you know, mundane. They want to be more sublime and more powerful and have this control over the life force. And that's why, you know, blood is being drank, because they have this control over somebody that, you know, presents themselves before them. Of course, there's all kinds of psychosexual aspects to this and everything else, if you really wanted to go into this from a very Freudian point of view. But just for face value, the idea of becoming a vampire gives power to those people that would otherwise be seen as weak.
All right, that aspect I get. And, you know, it's funny to me, though, like the original Bram Stoker Dracula is not this sexy, you know, Hungarian looking Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee or Frank Langella. Right. I mean, it's more in line with what we saw in the Nosferatu.
That's right. That's a great point. Whenever we think of vampires, we don't think of them as being these kind of creatures of the night. These are counts. These are people of wealth. These are people that are coming in to seduce you. And there is indeed a relevant connection to this idea of sexuality and vampirism that stretches back to the character of Lilith. Now, Lilith herself, I don't know if you've ever done a show just on this particular character.
No.
But there's about 2 or 3 hours for this figure that shows up not only in the Torah and in Jewish belief systems, but also in the Muslim belief systems as well as other systems of worship around the Mesopotamia. So we go back to the Akkadians, we go back to the Babylonians, we have this character of Lilith, and her name derives from the root that means darkness. But it's not until you get her into the Jewish culture that she really takes on this life of her own. She was the first consort for Adam. Before Eve was even created, she was believed to be the wife of Adam, but she would not subjugate herself to him. She refused to be on the bottom, let us say. She wanted to be, you know, on the top over him, whatever kind of images you want to use, but she would not allow herself to be subjugated by a man. So she was banned from the Garden of Eden, and then God creates Eve as somebody that would be subservient to the man. But Eve would have none of this. So as she left the garden, she goes into this primordial darkness, and in this primordial darkness, she meets one of the fallen angels, one of the Nephilim, if you will, or in some traditions, she meets Satan himself, and they become, you know, there's this great sexual affair that she has. So in the character of Lilith, we do see where the sexualization of the vampire comes from. And this is very, very, very early on. So what happens with Lilith is, because she was banned from humanity, she took it upon herself now to be the destroyer of mankind. And by doing that, she goes and she seeks out the children of Adam and Eve to consume them. And in my book, I present a lot of different prayers that was used against Lilith. And there was also even before we have the notion of the Judeo-Christian crucifix, well, the Christian crucifix, we have people putting up these amulets within their house to keep Lilith at bay. So that's another connection that we have to the ancient world, to use these incantations and these magical spells and these magical amulets to keep the creature of Lilith, which is a vampiric creature, out of your home.
Fascinating. Now, these are part of different religions. Did it ever appear in our version of the Bible, or was that cut out, prior to the King James renditions?
It does come into translation. There's sometimes whenever Lilith is called, especially in the book of Isaiah, she is called the night hag. We see little references here and there, or we see her as a night owl, a screech owl. But if you would go back into the linguistics of the idea and see where it comes from, what they are talking about is the same name for Lilith that would have been used in the Babylonian culture. We simply have corrupted it to make it more of an animal, something more naturally occurring, and then some sort of demonic beast out there. But that also, that's a great point. This all comes through from translation. But if you would look at this linguistically, we do see that the Old Testament, the Jewish Bible, does have references to these demonic figures that prowl about the world seeking the ruin of mankind.
That begs a very strange question, too, in the whole theology of the Bible, right? If God created these perfect beings and he created the birds of the sky and the animals of the land and man and woman, what happened that tainted Lilith? This was prior to the tree of knowledge, right? This wasn't like Lilith went and took a bite out of the apple and then opened up and she just went down a darker path than Eve did. This, she was tainted from the get-go.
She was tainted from the get-go.
And let me say real quickly here, sure, to our forward progressive thinking ladies and audience members, please do not send me hate mail. I'm not saying that she was considered tainted and evil because she was a forward thinking woman and wasn't going to put up with the shit of her man. I get that whole idea. I'm just saying, though, it seems funny that if God creates and God created these characters and in his image, that right from the get-go, our God wasn't getting things exactly right. I mean, if the platypus wasn't enough of a conundrum, he's got Lilith in mind, right? I mean,
well, yeah, it all, you know, this is from Jewish tradition. It would be shown as, you know, free will. Even created creatures have the ability to choose between good and evil. And she wasn't so much evil. She just chose not to be a servant to man. And, you know, she also has her own festival. I don't know if you, I'm sure a lot of your listeners remember the Lilith Festival back in the 1990s. That was a rock festival of only all girl bands. So Lilith did have her come up and eventually in an all girl music festival that shares her name. But I think that we're looking at the idea of free will, that this was a created creature supposed to be the wife of Adam, and they were supposed to live in wedded bliss, and she simply did not like the way she was treated, and she rebelled against it.
So right from the get-go, divorce was part of the lexicon, huh?
Absolutely, my friend. That's how you see it from the very beginning. And then, you know, the woman that is scorned then, of course, comes back to get the guy's kids. So you see this happening from the very beginning.
Interesting, right? We get a divorce and the bloodsuckers come in and drain us of all of our money and energy. Wow.
Exactly right. But, you know, when we talk about the character of Lilith, now, this is going to go even more and more into throughout history, because then we have the idea of where the garlic comes from. And it was interesting as I'm doing my research, because I'm going all these different type of avenues trying to get to the bottom of this great mystery of the vampire. And I discovered that there was a counterpart to Lilith within the Egyptian culture, and this was a creature of the night that came in and took the lives of babies. And of course, you know, we're talking about sudden infant death syndrome. We're talking about a lot of, you know, neonatal diseases that are out there that people didn't understand. So, of course, they personified them into the idea of this vampiric creature. But one of the things that was used to stimulate a baby suckling, which was incredibly important in the ancient world in order to take in nutrients, you know, quite readily, was the idea of taking garlic and rubbing it on the breast so the baby would be stimulated to eat. So as I'm looking at this, you know, now we see the idea of where garlic comes into play to keep these kind of creatures at bay, because a baby that's feeding early on is less apt to succumb to any of these childhood diseases or illnesses, or, you know, just you know, waste away from malnutrition. So we see the idea of the garlic keeping away the Lilith type of figures from the time of the ancient Egyptians.
Wow, fascinating, right? Now we know all of the medicinal purposes of garlic, and
That's right.
You wonder if that actually helped out these children, too, to live a longer life.
Well, It's been known to lower blood pressure. Of course, we get back to the idea of, you know, this constant concentration on the idea of blood and the way vampires, look at it as their life force. But I think that that's where we're really hitting it close to home, that we know that there are medicinal properties to garlic. And, you know, it's to keep those forces at bay that will do humanity harm.
Okay. This is just fascinating to me when you start digging into it this deeply. Is there an end story for Lilith? Does she fade away, or is she like a kind of superfluous character in a soap opera, and eventually her character is just kind of written out and forgotten about?
Well, the belief in the character of Lilith as something that is tangible kind of fades away. But you see, in the play Faust in the Renaissance, you see Lilith mentioned. And whenever we talk about how, the modern idea of the vampire, the True Blood series on HBO actually featured a character of Lilith. So she's gone, but she's not forgotten. She's not believed to be the one that creeps through the windows to still the life of a child anymore, but she's still out there in our kind of collective unconscious, and every now and then she appears in a music festival or on a TV show.
It's a hell of a gig if you can get it, I guess, right?
It is. That's exactly right. But, the Lilith that we talk about, though, takes on other names. You know, it's not the personification of this evil woman anymore. But when we think of something like tuberculosis, that takes on a very human aspect, too. And because, another word for tuberculosis is consumption, because it appears as if something is feeding off the human body and draining its energy. And we have instances throughout history, even into almost, modern history, well after the Civil War, up in New England, we have this great vampire craze that begins with the character of Mercy Brown. And that, I believe, was up in Rhode Island, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was in Exeter, Rhode Island. I could be wrong, but I think it was there. But yeah, Mercy Brown, her brother, or she died of consumption, and then her brother soon became sick. So it was believed by the town folk that, of course, Mercy was rising up out of the grave to keep on feeding upon the living. About 2 months after Mercy died, they go and they exhume the body, and they find out that she still has blood in her heart and some other organs. So this is a telltale sign that Mercy is rising from the grave to feed upon members of her family. So, not understanding what tuberculosis was and the diseases of consumption, they believed that she had become a vampire and was feeding upon, members of her family. So the only way to take care of this is to remove the heart, to burn the heart, and then mix the ashes with water and give it to the person that's inflicted. And they did give it to her brother, who died shortly thereafter, so that apparently did not work. But when we're talking about this, we're not talking about ancient history here. Mercy Brown died in 1892. This is after the Civil War, and this is actually inspiration that Bram Stoker would use in the creation of his masterwork Dracula. So, the Lilith of old might not be there, but our personification of other diseases, other inflictions upon humanity are there, and it was with us. I mean, look at that. I mean, 1892, that almost blows your mind that people were still doing this up into that present age, My grandmother was born in 1890, or my great-grandmother was born in 1890. So, we have a connection to this, what is also interesting about that particular thing is that this started the whole wave of the vampire craze up in New England, because as tuberculosis kind of latched on up there, they were seeing vampires everywhere, and this did happen throughout New England. Now, talking about fairies, almost at this exact same time over in Ireland, there was a man that was acquitted of manslaughter because he killed his wife, believed that she was a changeling, that the fairies had replaced his wife with an inferior fairy, a counterfeit of her. So this was going on, after the Civil War, whenever things seemed to be coming a little bit more modern, belief in fairies and belief in vampires was still very prominent. And we're not talking about, you know, in Ireland, you know, we're talking about more rustic areas. But when we think about New England, you know, we're talking about right outside of major industrial cities.
Who was the genius that thought, you know, this is how we cure it? We dig her up, we take out her heart, we burn it, we make it into ash, we stir it into a drink, and we give it to the person. That will give them the strength to stave it off. Because it's so matter of fact as though this is common knowledge. How did they even – that's what's so frightening to me about how people react to superstitions, right? I mean, let's make one superstition even freakier by adding a new superstition that's twice as dangerous.
That's right. Actually, that poor guy, I believe his name was Edwin or Edmund. I'm not sure, but it was we'll call him Ed. But Ed may have survived, you know, a bit longer rather than having to drink this tincture of his sister's ashy heart, you know, in a glass of water. But, you know, we are a nation of immigrants, and, you know, their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents brought all this stuff from all over Europe, because this kind of stuff was going on back in Europe, you know, throughout all of history. That if there was a suspected vampire, there was ways to get rid of it. In Italy, during the Middle Ages, there have been excavated cemeteries that found a large rock thrust into the mouth of the deceased, so that the, you know, if it would rise from the grave as a vampire, it wouldn't be able to bite anybody, you know. So we're bringing all these kind of ancient belief systems into America and making them our very own kind of thing. But if we look at the Amish, who are a very religious group, you know, we see hex signs even to this very day alongside barns. So, you know, even the people that are believed to be very religious still has this idea that the supernatural can influence our lives, and we must take steps to guard ourselves against that.
Right. Here's the genius behind the stupidity of humanity, in my opinion. We believe that this being is supernatural in nature. We believe that this being can rise from the dead at night, sneak into our homes, slake its thirst on the blood of the innocents. But if we put a brick in his mouth, he's screwed.
He's screwed. There's not a way that he can possibly take that brick out of his mouth.
Do vampires have T-Rex arms after they die?
Hey, you know what, though? That's a good point. That's a good point, because sometimes what they would do is they would cut the head off and put it down between the legs,
right,
or cut the legs off and make, you know, skulls and crossbones. So there were other ways of doing this as well. So it wasn't, you know, that might have been some tomfoolery going on there, because, you know, I'm thinking that guy could get up, he's just going to take that rock out of his mouth.
Right.
But there are other procedures to keep that person at bay. If we would go back really far in history, around the same time of this Cheddar Gorge incident that I talked about, with the finding of the three dead bodies alongside the animal carcasses there in that cave, right around that same time in Italy, there was found a burial that was just a human head by itself in one chamber of a cave, encircled by a palisade of stones. So it appeared to be that whoever belonged to that particular skull, they wanted to keep its soul there out of the way forever. So there are these other little tantalizing things throughout very ancient history, that there was a belief that the dead could indeed rise up to, you know, take its toll on the living.
Fascinating. Our guest, Ronald Murphy Jr., on vampires, as we talk about these strange creatures, their histories, the legends, the lore. And believe it or not, it's we're in the middle of our 12th year on the air of doing this show, in one variety or another. It's fascinating that I'm still learning more about vampires.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, how many vampire shows have we done over the years?
3,823.
I don't think that's true at all.
No?
No. The fact is, that's proof you're not a vampire, because you would be OCD and know that to the number.
Right.
But the fascinating aspect to me is that we're still finding out more, and there's more little bits of information that we can glean from these interviews. Ronald Murphy, our guest.
beyond darkness.
And we're back. This is Beyond the Darkness. And if you like stories about vampires, you like Dracula, you know Audible, Tim, has some of your favorite vampire stories available.
Really?
Yeah. And Audible is an Amazon company. They've got a special deal for listeners of Beyond the Darkness. As a matter of fact, you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/darkness. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And again, for the listeners of Beyond the Darkness, just go check out the free audiobook download and the free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. You are going to love it. And why not try Dracula? That's a great one to start with.
Yeah, it is.
Have you ever read the book Dracula, Tim?
Yes, I have.
It's a fascinating book, right?
Yes, it is.
And a lot of people don't realize. We've seen variations of it on screen,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think we've ever seen a true variation of it.
Yeah.
To date, I mean, it's much different than people know.
Mm-hmm.
So give yourself a great read and go get the Audible book, Dracula, or any one of the other fascinating books on vampires that they have. Again, remember to use audibletrial.com/darkness to get that 30-day free trial and a free audio book. I also want to mention this, Tim. This is a great episode to bring this up. We're going to be doing our trip this year. Our September trip sold out. August is still available to London, England, where we're going to go with Neil Story as our official host. And you've heard Neil on our show a number of times. He's a historian, researcher, and author. And we're going to follow in the footsteps of Jack Tripper. Yes. Come and knock on our door.
That'd be kind of fun, actually.
Yes. No, we're going to follow in the footsteps of Jack the Ripper, not Jack Tripper.
Okay.
And Bram Stoker's Dracula, as we get to visit some of the famous sites that he mentions throughout his book. We'll also get a chance to investigate haunted castles, haunted jails. We'll get a chance to see museums with fascinating artifacts and just some of the best and creepiest parts of history. This is truly made for the paranormal fan. So if you'd like to join us on that trip, then go check out darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. And we've got an event coming up even sooner at the Belvoir Winery, the Oddfellows Asylum. As you've seen it on Ghost Hunters and Ghost Adventures and Ghost Adventures Aftershocks, it is an amazing haunted location. I'll be out there with Bill Chappell and Chris Fleming doing an investigation over a weekend. We'd love for you to come out. You can come for one day or the full weekend. There's packages for everybody's budget. So check that out at darknessevents.com. And right now I'm going to make the announcement for 2018, Tim.
All right.
Romania. We're going back to follow Dracula. We'll follow in the very historic, famous footsteps of Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, and Bram Stoker's Dracula as we visit Transylvania and Romania. You're going to want to be a part of this. We are going to be visiting I think it's called the Baisu Forest, Tim. I'm horrible at these words.
Okay.
The haunted forest. We're going to be visiting haunted castles, churches, and more. Plus, we get to visit the gravesite of Vlad Tepes, the last known gravesite of the real Dracula. So we've got that going on, and we would love to hear from you. We'll be making that available very soon. And if you would like to be put on the mailing list, email me, dave@darknessradio.com, dave@darknessradio.com, and just put in your subject line, Dracula 2018, and we will get you the information as soon as it is available. But we won't be making that on sale, I don't think, until later this year, maybe September, October.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be for later into 2018. So hopefully you'll join us for that. Remember, I'm hosting Coast to Coast AM this weekend. And stay tuned after our regular show here on Beyond the Darkness tonight for a small taste, a snippet of True Crime Tuesday. If you haven't already subscribed, make sure you go sign up for it right now. You can do that by visiting darknessradio.com and clicking on the True Crime Tuesday banner. And then it'll take you in where you can sign up. Only $5 a month gets you 4 90-minute to 120-minute episodes every week. That's right. Every week you get a brand new episode. Plus, we might be uploading some of our classic favorites from the past so that you can hear some of the old ones as well as an additional bump. How about that, Tim? We're givers.
We are givers.
So
yeah.
We'll be giving away some of our favorite old True Crime Tuesday episodes that many of you may not have ever heard and have no way to find. We'll start offering those on the site as well here in June. We'll be adding an extra episode that'll be a flashback episode, but you're guaranteed at least four brand new 90-minute to 120-minute episodes for only $5 a month. That's just a buck and a quarter. Go sign up right now, and you'll be able to hear our show, a little snippet tonight right after this show of The Curse, The Last Word, an amazing True Crime Tuesday episode. You guys are not going to want to miss it. Listen to the snippet right after tonight's show. Ronald Murphy Jr. is here with us discussing his book on vampires. And Ron, let's get back into this lore, because this is really intriguing stuff for me, and I'm sure many of our listeners. So we've kind of heard of the legend of Lilith. We've heard about some of the fairy connections with this creature. What were some of the more fascinating revelations that you were able to uncover while doing research for a book like this?
I think some of the more fascinating ones has really nothing to do with the legendary aspects, but the genuine people that we identify with as vampires now. And this is actually going to tie into your trip, and I didn't mean it to do this way, but you know, let me plug away. I am definitely going to sign up for your email list, because that trip to Transylvania is actually sounding quite good. But whenever we think of the vampire, we definitely think of Vlad the Impaler, and Transylvania really has this unbelievable tie to vampire lore. And the reason for that is, not only do they have the idea of vampiric creatures there, but they also have the idea of, you know, the ability to transform. So a lot of werewolf legends come from there, and the haunted forest that you had mentioned as well, a name which I'm not even going to try to pronounce either. But, you know, there's been centuries of fairy lore that comes from that particular area as well. This is a place that's believed to be alive with intelligent elemental spirits. So one of the most fascinating elements that I had in getting really to the bottom of the book is the actual true history of some of the people that we now think of as vampires. But in truth, they really aren't. But they are forever seared into our consciousness that these are vampires. So if we would look at somebody like Vlad the Impaler, who died probably right around 1477 sometime, you know, if you would go to Romania, he's almost a George Washington type figure, right, over there. You know, he was on the side of the Pope. He was actually commended by the Roman Catholic Church for his fight against the infidels and, you know, the Turks and such. But his life was a very fascinating life, and also a very sad life as well, too. Early on, his father gave him over to the Turks as, you know, as sort of a surety that there was going to be peace. And from all accounts that I've collected, you know, this young adolescent Vlad, who was, you know, no more than a boy, was treated horribly by the Turks. There's probably a lot of very bad things that happened to this. If you would think of a group of men throwing a very scared little boy, the kind of things that could happen. So whenever I, you know, I'm starting to research the idea of why he chose the form of impaling as his preferred method of torture, it seems to be that the stake that they used for the impalement was, you know, inserted in such a way that it would pass through the anal cavity and out through the mouth to keep the victim as alive as long as possible. But this may indeed reflect in the kind of treatment that that poor kid had endured at the hands of his tormentors while he was, you know, in captivity. So, I mean, there's a lot of really personal stories that come out whenever you look at the world of the vampire. A lot of very true life stories that we really don't have to go in to say what they symbolize and what they don't symbolize. You know, and the other person was Elizabeth Bathory. So if anybody takes your trip to Transylvania, over in Hungary, we have Elizabeth doing her things over there. But her family all derived from Transylvania, which is pretty close. But she died in 1614, and she's actually listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most prolific female serial killer. She killed probably around 650 people, and what she did, what makes her fit into our idea of the vampire, is that when she would kill these, you know, innocent peasant girls, you know, of course the idea of virgin blood is very prominent in our understanding of the vampire from a modern perspective, but she would bathe in the blood of these young women because she believed the blood had the power to keep her young and to give her eternal life. But, you know, she went through a very, these people weren't simply killed. They were tortured. They were burned. This was a chamber of horrors that these 650 people were kept and the kind of things that they had to endure. So at the end of the book on vampires, I wasn't so much afraid of what we would call the vampire as I am afraid of what the human being is capable of doing.
Right. The real life fleshies are a lot more dangerous than the supernatural counterparts. That's for sure.
Without a doubt. And so as a researcher and as a documentarian and somebody that looks at this from, you know, a Jungian perspective and the idea of the creation of an archetype, I think that these things like these boogeymen, these vampires, these werewolves, what have you, you can name any kind of monster. The reason why it's so important to have monsters out there is because it takes a little bit of who we are as humans away from us. We can now blame something else. But isn't it fascinating that all these monsters look like us? You know, they walk upright. You know, they come in the visage of a person. Of course, they can transform. But at the end of the day, these are, you know, monsters in human form. And that is simply because we as human beings cannot accept what people are capable of doing. You know, we eat our own kind. There's cannibalism throughout our history. You know, that is in our closet as you know, as who we are as Homo sapiens. You know, there's not a doubt. But we have, you know, kind of personified this cannibalism into some sort of creature of the night that prowls around, when in actuality it was us. And, you know, the idea of taking human blood to think that it gives us eternal life, you know, that has to be a monster. No, it doesn't. Somebody that was of noble birth actually tried to do this, you know, in the Renaissance, you know, right around the time of Shakespeare's death, there was somebody bathing in human blood thinking it was going to give them human life. So at the end of the day, this is more of an indictment against human beings as it is against any kind of monster.
What do you make of the history of vampires and some of the legends that turned real? Have you found cases to believe that there may be real supernatural elements to this storyline?
Absolutely. And now, like I said, I'm flattered that I'm on your show, but there is so much information here, so I'm going to try to download as much information as I can. But yes, that's one of the fascinating things about this book, because human beings cannot explain every kind of thing that has happened, you know, the way we have the images of these vampires. So as I was looking, and I look at this from a very Freudian point of view as well, too, looking at the idea of anomalous natural sciences involved here. And it keeps on coming back to the idea of the bat. The bat is something that is prominent in vampire lore since the very beginning. Even Lilith was portrayed not so much as a bat, but as a winged entity. But over time, it definitely became a bat-like form. But as I told you earlier, in the Bible, she was represented as a screech owl. But the idea that these creatures are capable of flight and they sneak into your house. You know, the reason why the vampire bat is called the vampire bat is not simply because it drinks blood, but it is very anthropomorphic in the way it does it. You know, if any of the listeners care to look it up, you go to YouTube and just, you know, type in vampire bat and you can see how they go about feeding. They actually, you know, will walk upright and do this really weird kind of skipping gait until it comes to its prey, and then it will bite them and just start consuming the blood. But it's very human-like in the way that it moves. You know, it immediately strikes us as something that we can identify with. So I keep on coming back into my research that there may indeed have been a bat to blame for some of these predations, especially in ancient history. Now, what kind of bat could it be? Now, when we look at mega bats today, there are some in the Philippines that have, you know, wingspans of nearly 6 feet. So we're talking about a very massive creature here. But they are all fruit eaters. You know, these are herbivores. But there might be the possibility that at some time there was some sort of convergent evolution going on that kind of toyed with the idea of a flesh-eating bat. Now, Linnaeus, you know, who we get our famous classification from, he proposed in 1758 that there may indeed have been a flying ape. Now, this comes out as the flying ape hypothesis. Now, that seems a little outlandish, but in 1980, a gentleman by the name of J.D. Smith, who was an academician, he actually resurrected this idea that there may have one time been a flying ape. Now, Jack Pettigrew, in 1986, he is a scientist from Australia. He actually kind of proposed this even further. There was DNA testing going on to see if there could be a link to the bats and to an ape ancestor someplace. Now, mainstream science says, no, indeed, there was no link there. But there is still a school of thought that if there was not a flying ape that had a direct lineage to our bats today, there may have been a dead end where there was some sort of ape-like creature that was able to take on flight. Now, if this creature was large enough, if it was the size of a modern-day fruit bat, if you will, but it was able to take blood, could you imagine something like this coming into a village and creeping through a window or going through a crack in a door and making its way almost like a vampire bat across the room in order to feed? You know, our idea of a vampire having a cape could relate directly to our cultural memory of these wings that it's, you know, it enfolds itself with. So the idea that the vampire is just a personification of disease and all the things that are wrong with humanity, it doesn't completely rule out the idea that there might be a cryptid involved with this as well. And that is something I'm still researching, you know. Any book that I write always leaves me with more questions than answers, and I think that's always a good thing. But there is, at least in some strains of scientific research, the idea that there may have been at one time, you know, it might have been a evolutionary dead end, but there may have been a time whenever there was some sort of ape-like creature that was able to attain flight. And if that was the case, and if it was similar to the vampire bat, this might bring us full circle to why we see vampires as, you know, wearing capes, as, you know, feeding on blood, and how they creep into a house and such. But I think that's all very, very fascinating.
Right, and that there are all of these possibilities that exist for why we believe the things we believe. And some of them sound so far-fetched, but I think people really forget still that it's been less than 150 years since we found the gorilla and proved that it existed.
Exactly. I think what happens is when we sit down to a computer, we can Google anything, that it kind of insinuates that human beings know all that there is out there. And that is definitely 100% not the case. The first book that I ever wrote on this On series about my cultural perspective and my cultural research into different creatures around the world, mythological creatures, cryptid creatures, what have you. But the first book that I wrote in this series was called On Mermaids. And I think that it's relevant to point out here that we know more about the surface of the moon than we do about our world's oceans, you know. And so there are plenty of things out there that are yet to be discovered. And just because things don't show up on our fossil record does not mean that they did not exist. You know, the idea of, you know, the Yowie down in Australia, you know, people think that couldn't be possible. You know, there's no reason there could be an ape-like creature down there and everything. But I was able to interview Carl Schuker not too long ago, and he has a proposal that there may have indeed been a marsupial type of ape in Australia at one time, and that might have lent credence to what we now call the Yowie. So there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophies these, as Hamlet would say in Shakespeare's play. And I think that that's the way we need to look at things. You know, we're not a bunch of crackpots or nut jobs out here, although there are people in the field that are like that. But I'm trying to look at this from as a scientific point of view as humanly possible. I'm trying to scrutinize this stuff very skeptically, and I'm trying to really get to the heart of the matter. But after everything is removed, after all the layers are taken off, we're still left with mysteries. And some of those mysteries might be solved by thinking there is something what we would call paranormal involved in these stories.
I like the aspect too that you know, you've got all of these cultures that share similar versions or beliefs in this, and they didn't seem to come from the same places, right? These stories sprung up independent of one another. It's really weird. I mean, is that the 100 monkey philosophy? Once 100 monkeys know it or think about it, it spreads like a wildfire, like a downloaded virus to the ethernet of the world, the Akashic records, and we all just have like this inspiration that it existed.
Right. See, again, because I'm so immersed in the idea of Jungian philosophy and psychology, you know, that would be the reasoning behind that, that it's some sort of, well, I mean, that in and of itself is almost, you know, paranormal, that there's some sort of psychic connection to the human family, and thoughts can take on life of its own and everything. So that's, you know. But what else is going on? Especially if you look back into the ancient world, whenever somebody in England is having the same ideas as cultures in Africa or cultures in Eastern Europe, you know, without the internet and without a common language and without any ways of sharing these ideas, how did this all come about? You know, so what I am saying is that, you know, the human family, what we call humanity, was experiencing something that we simply cannot understand, you know, back in our ancient history. And that is why we now have things like the vampire and things like the werewolf and things like, you know, Bigfoot and any other kind of, you know, anomalous type of creature that you can think of, is because something was out there to give rise to these legends. And it sticks with us even to this very day. It's part of who we are.
Now, is there any truth, any medicinal truth to drinking blood? Is there any health advantages to it at all?
It can be quite dangerous. Let's put it that way. Blood doesn't have a lot of nutritional. You have to process it. You know, our human bodies are not built for processing blood, so it really doesn't do much for us. You know, things like vampire bats, you know, they are capable of getting nutrients from that. So the idea of that, from a human standpoint, little to none. I mean, there are diseases out there like porphyria that will cause an aversion to sunlight. So there are some diseases that have vampire-like elements to them. But the idea of drinking blood, the idea of blood having power, is old. I mean, look, even in Jewish customs, whenever, you know, they would take animals to slaughter them at the altar in Jerusalem, or the idea even of, you know, not to sound sacrilegious, I'm a practicing Catholic, but the idea of even Holy Communion, the idea of bread, you know, the bread becoming the body and the wine becoming the blood of Jesus, you know, that idea of the consumption of blood to give us life is a part of who we are, you know. So, I mean, we have to look at it from a whole bunch of different perspectives. Does it have any kind of genuine food value? Absolutely not. Not for who we are as human beings nowadays. But there is something special about it. There's something metaphysical about it that we still yearn to reach out for. You know, we understand that it gives life. We understand that it's capable of sustaining us. But, you know, why? You know, it's very metaphysical. It's very transcendent. It's very, you know, even religious. But the idea of blood and the human being and who we are, you know, that is with us. That's with us to stay.
Now, you'd mentioned that you wrote on mermaids as well. Some of the mermaid stories sound pretty chilling and very vampiric in nature. These these creatures that can appear beautiful and then change at the drop of a hat, right? I mean, even in Peter Pan's world, Neverland, they were these beautiful but vampiric creatures.
That's right. That's
but
right.
Dave, yeah, I'm aware that that Peter Pan's world is pretend. But I'm just saying that they've even embraced that in the cartoon world, and in that there is a deeper, weirder side.
Well, sure, and that's a great point, because I have 5 books in the series right now. I have on Wild Man, which is investigating Bigfoot, on Vampires, which is my newest one, on Mermaids was my first one, on Dogman, which covers the werewolf, and then even I have one on Ghosts. So that's my collection up until now. But as I'm researching any of these types of things, we always see a constant overlap, even with the idea of ghosts. You know, the idea of Lilith keeps on cropping up again and again, because she was supposed to be the mother of these types of spirits called the jinn, which sometimes appear in Islamic folklore as ghosts. But getting back to mermaids, absolutely. Yeah, these things which seem quite beautiful and sing a siren song and lure people onto the rocks. You know, they do that so they can feed upon the flesh of these sailors, you know. And when we look at the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, mermaids were often depicted in artwork carved in stone right on the churches as a symbol for, you know, any man to be wary of going off of the straight and true path and giving into their lust and, you know, succumbing to these kind of creatures that exist in the liminal areas, because, you know, you give into your lust, you give into your sexual temptations, you are going to be crashing on the rocks, both literally and metaphorically.
Right. Oh, wow. Just so strange. We can talk about, you know, and if you don't mind us dipping into it a bit, you talk about the vampire legends. You talk about the fact that they can morph and change. And then we talk about things like the dogman or werewolf scenario. Where do you stand on that? Are there connections? You know, if we believe that things like Native American skinwalkers can exist, these humans that have the ability to shift either their visual look or shift mentally to these creatures and take on their attributes. You know, first of all, I guess I should ask, do you believe that that is a possibility?
I think from an intellectual point of view, the idea of physical transformation is almost an impossibility. But from a mental process, I think absolutely. If your people are, especially when we're talking about Aboriginal societies that have a close connection with the land, the idea of somehow having the ability to believe that they have transformed, 100%. This is common in shamanic cultures throughout the world. The idea of being able to transform from one state of being to another one. Absolutely, that does exist. You know, I will lay my reputation on that. It might not be a physical transformation, but the transformation definitely exists.
What is the, you know, I mean, there's this legend and lore of this kind of rivalry between vampires and werewolves that has gone back, you know, through all of the literature versions of it. But if Dracula can basically, or, you know, vampires can possibly change into wolves, doesn't that seem like a strange rivalry?
It does. It does. Now, the interesting point is that the idea of a vampire changing into a wolf is not really found until we hit Bram Stoker. And the reason for that, a lot of critics will say, is this was Stoker's way of addressing Darwinism that was really sweeping the world. That, you know, the vampire embodied the Victorian belief that man can somehow usurp the idea of Darwinism and de-evolve into lesser animals and still be, you know, the man at the end of the day. So I think there's a lot of things that Stoker was actually dealing with from, you know, a religious point of view, and actually as kind of like the middle finger up to the establishment. But the idea of transformation, though, is definitely something that we see in the fairy world. And there are tons of incidences where these fairy creatures transform into wolves or transform into bats, or transform into giant birds. Actually, in Ireland, there's a very famous area where one of the inhabitant sprites will transform into a bird, which is very reminiscent of what we would call the Thunderbird over here in America. So, you know, there's, again, as you said, it's like almost unpeeling an onion. There's layer upon layer. And we're talking about cultures that don't even know each other that are having very, very similar beliefs. So this cannot be completely cut and dry. There is something going on out there in the world that are giving these cultures the idea, the nascence behind the legends that they have.
These monsters that you know, live in the night, these wolf creatures, these vampiric creatures that are out there and part of, you know, whether you want to call it fantasy, fable, or, you know, maybe riding the fringe of reality, it captures the imagination of people around the world, right? The idea that there is transformation in all of us and that we can be powerful and maybe more powerful than we give ourselves credit for. Why do you think it always takes to the dark side to give us those power, you know, those powers, that it needs to be the taking of innocent lives to gain strength to do this? Or is this more of a, you know, part of the reason I love George Romero's work is they were social works. When you watch The Night of the Living Dead and The Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, it was each one is a social work and a contemporary look at reality that was going on at that time. And you've got the racial upheaval and everything, and how do people work together in a confined environment? And then in the, you know, Day of the Dead, you've got the mall, and you've got what's the first place everybody's going to head to when, you know, they're looking for safety is this consumerism, right? We're going to go to the mall and hide out in the mall. And then Day of the Dead is our kind of our fear and mistrust of the government and what they're capable of doing. Do you look at some of the vampire legend and lores and these monsters and see that same kind of thread that as they rise in popularity and not that there's some kind of correlation between what's going on socially?
And that was actually beautifully stated. I really don't have to add anything to that. I think you did a remarkable job summing it all up. I'm actually talking to you right now about 35 miles outside of Pittsburgh, where George Romero filmed his Night of the Living Dead series. So the idea of zombies is very prevalent. It's been with me since I've been a kid because, you know, this is zombie central, if you will. But, yeah. Social commentary, that's absolutely what was going on, especially whenever we get people in the Renaissance and beyond writing about vampires. When we get into the notion of what a vampire is with sexuality, that is definitely a Victorian thing. If you would give into your sexuality, that was not accepted. Bad things could happen. You're breaking with the norm. But before Dracula was written, there was a writer by the name of Fanu, F-A-N-U, and he wrote a book called Camilla, which is a book about a lesbian vampire. And if you would read it, there is a lot of innuendo going on. The main character says that she's feeling things that she's never felt before, you know, almost these kind of orgasmic images that's going on. But she was being preyed upon by a female vampire. So we do see commentary, and that's basically what is going on. We talk about these creation of these archetypes, you know. It's a commentary upon people that give into their animal instincts, you know. Whenever they feed and hunt like wolves, we go back to the cave then in England. You know, this was not done by one individual. This was done by a group of individuals. So this was something that was planned. So, you know, that seems like such an evil thing. But good and evil didn't exist until we really come up to the idea of, you know, sin and death and Satan and all that stuff. So when we talk about what was happening in life, like back in the idea of Mesopotamia and the idea of Lilith, this was basically giving in to everything that makes you not human. You know, it's giving away your humanity. It's submitting to these dark forces that we have to suppress in order to be members of civilization. You know, if we do not suppress these things, we become an animal and we live on the fringes of humanity. And that's where these creatures live as well, too, right? I mean, we do not find vampires, you know, living in our modern cities. They're brought to us. You know, they live in places like Transylvania, where werewolves stalk these haunted forests, and it's only whenever we venture into these places do we meet these things. And that could be a commentary on vampires about, you know, there's the belief not to allow them into your home. Don't invite them into your home. Now, if you know, we look at this from a lot of different perspectives. You know, are we talking about inviting somebody into the house for, you know, sexual pleasures and the things that could come to it? Or we're talking about inviting somebody into our house that might have a disease, such as the bubonic plague, and infecting everybody else? So there's this idea of letting down one's guard and inviting this onto yourself. And definitely it is a commentary on how we see other people, how we see the world around us. And it's not until we get into later times that the idea of good and evil, it's just bad choices that can ultimately lead to our death, which was the original commentary for a myriad of different types of creatures like the vampire.
Hey, we've only got a few brief moments left together, but with this book, what do you really want people to get from it? What are you hoping that they'll pick up and read that may be totally new and surprising to them?
Well, vampires have been going through a cycle of becoming very popular to not so popular, but they will always be with us. So whenever we think of these kind of glittering vampires from the Twilight series, you know, that's what is the reason why we have glittering vampires now, but, you know, 100 years ago, they were the Count from Transylvania. You know, what I'm trying to get at is, so whenever people are reading about certain things, to just open up their mind and think about the reasoning behind these great literary characters like Dracula, or the history behind Vlad Tepes, and think about how they all fit into our worldview of the vampires. I mean, when we sit down and watch the show Lost Boys with Kiefer Sutherland, you know, we don't think about, you know, the vast tradition that these kind of characters arose out of. So I think what my goal is, and it always has been, whether I'm writing something academically or something paranormal, is to basically to have an open mind and to think and to consider the world around you, because it makes it much more interesting if it's more than just black and white. I always like to have a little bit of a gray area in there as well, too. But yes, folks, just keep an open mind and let us not completely rule out anything paranormal until we explore all avenues.
All right. Ronald Murphy Jr., our guest, and we'll put up a link to his website so you can follow along with him and on his Facebook page. You can follow him on Twitter at CryptoGuruRon. And keep up with them there. On Vampires, that's the name of the book we've been discussing. So make sure that you check that out for yourselves. Remember, it's True Crime Tuesday. Stay tuned after the show to hear a snippet from today's episode. And then make sure you go over and subscribe by going to darknessradio.com, clicking on the True Crime Tuesday tab, the button there, and then subscribing so you never miss a best in the true crime talk radio genre with your buddies Dave and Tim. That's it for today. We'll be back again tomorrow. Betsy Lewis, our guest, Ancient Serpent Gods, the alien connection to reptilian dinosaurs. That's here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Jesse Quackenbush, he's our guest and has done a documentary, The Last Word, which is the documentary about Johnny Frank Garrett and the wrongful execution. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us like this last minute and being a part of the show.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Let's start from the beginning for you on this. What convinced you to bring this story out and into the forefront?
It was Texas has led the nation in capital punishment and executions for as many years as it's been since we started reinstituting those. And with that, because district attorneys in Texas are elected, it became very, very clear early on in the political process that executions were politically popular with getting reelected. So we saw a flurry in Texas of people getting charged with capital offenses and eligible for the death penalty starting in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was such a popular thing to do that DAs literally would go out of their way to make sure someone got the needle, as they used to call it, because that almost assured that they would be popular for reelection again. So as I was just coming out of law school around 1987, I migrated to Panhandle of Texas and went to work for a civil rights lawyer named Jeff Blackburn, who was one of the founders of the Innocence Project. And one of the appeals he was working on was the Johnny Frank Garrett case. So although I didn't work on the case directly, I was peripherally involved with the tragedy that started to unfold over the next 7 or 8 years as he slowly proceeded towards execution. Ultimately, intervention from the Pope didn't work. Ann Richards was the governor of Texas back then. You know, she didn't do the right thing. She did the politically correct thing and didn't halt his execution because she had her eyes on possibly running for the presidency. So he got caught up in this whirlwind of politics and unfortunately was executed. Went to death row and on his deathbed claimed his innocence, as he had from the very beginning. So being in that community, watching that story unfold was really compelling. So I started researching, talking with some of the witnesses that were still available. And this was around the mid-90s after his execution. And, you know, the story was compelling in itself, but the fact that he cast a curse at the very end, basically promising everyone involved with his death a similarly violent ending to their own lives, and then slowly watching as that curse came true, you know, it wasn't just a compelling story, it was freaky.
Subscribe now for True Crime Tuesday by visiting darknessradio.com and clicking the True Crime Tuesday banner. Never miss another episode of True Crime Tuesday and Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Go there now, darknessradio.com, and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. Do it now.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24 month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.